America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Bidding wars all over the country for houses. Ask $400,000 and have three overbids at $425,000. We've all heard the stories of a house going up on the market on Tuesday and sold on Wednesday. Buyers are coming in with lots of cash and good credit. So for those who worry that there's a bust just around the corner from every boom, perhaps this one is different. It certainly differs in significant ways from the housing market crash that brought us to our economic knees in 2009. And there are already signs that it's all slowing just slightly because of price spikes and the lack of homes on the market. We attack this issue from every conceivable angle with a real estate economist who offers great insights, whether you're a buyer or a seller. That's all today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Ken H. Johnson, and he is a real estate economist at Florida Atlantic University. And in fact, he's also the associate dean there of graduate programs. And somebody who back in 05 and 06 was telling people that maybe there was something to be concerned about as it relates to housing. And we had a boom just about ready to emerge at that time. And Ken, we've got another boom on our hands. Should we be concerned today?
We absolutely should be concerned with prices because they are rising at a rather extraordinary rate. However, right now, I concentrate mostly in Southeast Florida. So, however, if I look at the markets in Southeast Florida today, housing market, and compare it to the market back in 05 and 06, today we can measure that our housing on average in Southeast Florida is 13%, is selling at prices 13% above, based on a long-term pricing trend, 13% above where it should be. So we can estimate where housing prices should be based on past prices.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can say, well, okay, that's where we should be. But where are we? And we're about 13% above where we should be. Now, that rate is going up every month. It's increased 1% each of the last 2 months. And that's pretty disturbing. But if we go back to 05 and 06 and we do the same measure at the peak of the cycle, we were 65% above where we should be. So today is very concerning, but it's not as concerning as where we were 15 years ago. And I feel like most people should know that because people don't measure this every day. They just notice prices are rising rapidly again. And the last time prices rose rapidly like this, we had this huge cratering in the housing market. Are we in trouble? There's going to be a pricing event. Not going to happen tomorrow, but it's not going to be as bad as last time. It won't be anything like last time.
Well, so most people like yourself who look at this think that there are fewer systemic risks going on, that we don't have some of the gamesmanship going on in the financial markets that is leading to this boom, that there are better fundamentals. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. It was a true perfect storm 15 years ago. We have far better credit that's out there now. We're not facing a foreclosure crisis. People are building equity in their houses. They have near record credit levels. In other words, good credit is pervasive throughout the economy now, which it wasn't so 15 plus years ago. We have a shortage in housing. There's just so many fundamentals that are underpinning the pricing right now, even though it's high. There's just no reason to suspect a major collapse like we had the last time.
does every housing boom suggest that at the other end there's going to be a bust, or no?
No, it doesn't mean that there's going to be a boom for every housing, every peak of the housing cycle. Sometimes it's more like a cresting wave, and you can look at it back through time, and what might have seemed significant in early 1980s paled in comparison to what happened in 2005 and 6. So there's just not every housing boom relates in a housing collapse.
When you do look at the moment that we're in, a lot of uncertainty politically, a lot of division in the country, then, of course, the pandemic. We can't underestimate the effect of the pandemic on all that has been going on. But people making a lot of life-changing decisions at a time when many of us decided we really wanted to stay put. And we wanted to just rest in our homes. I was a little bit surprised. I live in Connecticut, Ken, and you're looking at it, 30,000 people move from New York to Connecticut in this short period of time.
There's a lot of things to unpack there, Larry. One of the things that was pretty well accepted by all housing economists back in early 2020 was that there was going to be a housing collapse if we didn't solve the COVID crisis very quickly. Clearly, we all missed it. So a couple things came about that caused us to miss this. Number one, we approached near record low mortgage rates. Additionally, the pandemic did not strike uniformly across the different age groups. So if you were in your 20s to 50s, it was not as much of a health risk as to that group as others. And this group was in a prime age to be buying. They're getting record low interest rates. They accepted virtual touring way beyond what anybody believed. So people started eliminating houses by way of virtual touring and going and seeing that last house or two, or even buying directly off of an online viewing. So we had all of a sudden this huge demand for housing. Throw on a systemic change, and boy, we need to be more suburban in style. So we've seen a little bit of an increase in overall home ownership, not much, point and a half in the U.S., but this demand for ownership and people even reshuffling where they live and how they live has driven prices up significantly. Politically, both parties seem to strongly support this concept of ownership and building equity as the way to create more wealth. We're pretty well on the record as saying, now, wait a minute, that's one way to create wealth. Renting and reinvesting very often, most often, beats ownership and building equity. Not significantly. So we do measure 23 major cities around the country, and it's about a toss-up in half the cities right now. So that's because pricing houses are getting too high too fast. So both sides politically strongly support this age-old wisdom of, you know, don't throw your money away on rent. That's not always true. So not only are Americans moving to the suburbs to own, many are moving to the suburbs to rent. And so we're seeing now, because of the housing shortage across the board, rising rents and rising prices.
That's interesting that you say that about rent, because you don't hear that very often, that perhaps if you put it into the stock market and not putting it into your house. I mean, I've always said that my house isn't really of much value to me until I decide to sell it. And then now, if I sold it in this market, I'm going to be paying on the other side of the equation a lot more to get into something else.
Housing is a tricky investment. Because it's not just an investment good, Larry. It's both an investment and a consumption good. People buy the house because it's cute, the house they're going to live in. They like the neighborhood. They want their kids to go to certain schools, certain amenities in the house. People do not buy financial assets because they're cute. They buy them for a return. But housing ownership, and to a great extent even renting, serves that dual role of consumption and investment, right? So if you will set a balance to where I can rent and reinvest those monies that I would put into housing for ownership, or I can buy the same exact property, and we can statistically measure this, which way on average wins out. And right now in the U.S., we get about 10 cities that are in the buy, or in what we would call buy territory, where you should be buying and building equity in terms of creating more wealth on average. And then we've got another 13 cities that you could get out there and you would be better off to rent and reinvest to create more wealth. Now, I would tell you this. The difference between the two is very marginal in total wealth creation. There's going to be a winner. It's just you've got two fast runners running 100 meters. There's going to be a winner, but the other guy's going to be pretty close. What no one should be considering, and what many do, unfortunately, is when they do rent, they don't reinvest into a portfolio of stocks and bonds. They simply spend the difference on beer and cookies on that consumption, right? And so we don't encourage that. Do one of those two. Rent and reinvest or own. Okay.
Now, buyers today seem to have higher credit ratings. Some people are putting down just a whole bunch of cash on these new houses. Not, I shouldn't say new, because that's a whole other aspect to all of this that we'll talk about. But on these existing homes, many of them are putting down $500,000 on a $1 million purchase. Are you surprised at the cash that a lot of Americans have to put into housing today?
Not exactly, because we've seen an increase in savings significantly, and we've seen an inflation in all financial assets. And again, a house is part of is a financial asset. Financial assets are anything that you can own and gather cash flows from. So if you're owning it, you're avoiding rent. So that's your way of gathering periodic cash flows. So you would say, well, why would people put so much money into the home? Well, even at 3% financing, that's a pretty good return. Many people are choosing to pay down their mortgages because they can treat their mortgages like a bond, and they can earn this 3% plus or minus return. That's about the 30-year long-term mortgage rate, which is a pretty good return as compared to, boy, if I just stick it in the bank and earn the Super Saver CD level, which is a tenth of a percent or something. I'm not surprised because of this that we see more and more property have greater and greater amounts of equity. And this only secures the housing market even more because it entrenches people in their ownership. If you've got $500,000 into a $1 million property, you're not going to walk away when the market gets a little shaky.
It seems as if the biggest winners in today's boom are people who already own homes, who gained a collective, 1.5 trillion in equity in 2020 from a year earlier. But who are the losers, if any, in this process?
So if we'll go back to those three states, rent and don't reinvest, rent and reinvest, or buy and build equity, the clear losers have been the renters that spend the difference on beer and cookies, that spend the difference on that they would have otherwise spent on ownership. They spend it on just consumption. The winners have been those people that have either bought, meaning owning the home and built equity, or rented a similar property and reinvested those monies that they would have spent on housing into a portfolio of stocks and bonds, roughly a 60-40 split. We measure this every 3 months, and we can adjust the portfolio size for risk of a housing market. And those last two groups, renting and reinvesting and ownership, they have clearly won because not only have housing prices gone up, so have stocks, right?
Yep.
So they've really benefited. Those people that have just rented and spent the difference on consumption have really been hurt by this.
As a real estate economist, you obviously look at the psychology of all of this, and COVID has resulted in a lot of rethinking about where we live, why we live there, where we work, how we work. And yet I'm not certain that this is a long-term thing. In other words, I'm hearing a lot of people who moved to Connecticut say, now I've got to figure it out because my boss wants me back in New York 3 or 4 times a week, and they've moved pretty far out. And some of our train and transit isn't that great to get back in. How important is all this infrastructure building that we talk about and spending to making what we've seen happen in 2020 easily purposeful for people who've moved away from where their jobs really exist.
So to the extent we've actually seen efficiencies from working remotely, which many people are better working remotely and many people are not. And so there's a lot to shake out in the long run. But I would say that the cost of a move, especially if those people that transition from, say, the city to Connecticut or New York City to South Florida, which we've seen a lot of people move from the New York metro area into South Florida, if you buy in your new area, the transaction costs are approaching 10 to 20% every time you transact. That's an anchor. That ties you down. I don't think you're going to see that many people running that quickly back to the city. Now, where we go in the long run, I don't know, but I do think we're going to see more and more people working remotely. Let's just say that. You know, I can see small commercial pods already developing in Southeast Florida where I'm going to go have an office and here in Boca Raton where I live, but I actually work in Miami. So I rent a small private office and I go there and I work from there. That's kind of an odd thing, but these little rehab projects, these real estate rehab projects are starting to pop up. Will they survive? Will they be prosperous? I don't know, but we're a long ways from going back to where we were. And personally, I don't think we're going to get anywhere close to what we used to be. I think there's going to be a major overhaul in how much time we spend in offices in close proximity to one another. But there's an optimal mix to that. And so I think there's got to be some. There's got to be some value to being in close proximity to one another and some value in working remotely.
New York City, let's take that as an example. It was so hot, as were places like Atlanta and Austin and San Francisco, young people flocking there. And then there was this COVID, and a lot of people moved back with their parents or moved away because their company had shut down its headquarters. Now, I'm hearing that New York City is starting to get really expensive again, that rents are really going up again. There used to be a lot of empties in a building, a woman I was talking to over the weekend, and she said they're all filled up and they're highly priced. So we were moving toward an urban future with a lot of young people, but now we see that some of them have decided to park in the suburbs. Explain what you see happening there.
So, and I'll address New York City specifically. The demise of New York real estate, New York City real estate has been predicted so many times, and they've been wrong every time. So there's something about New York City that it's true. In the last few years, you've seen so many people depart the city for South Florida, Nashville, Connecticut, Dallas, Texas, and you could hear the arguments over weather, taxes, business opportunity, et cetera. You've heard this time and time again about New York City, and it's always come back. It is the urban business center of U.S. business. It is where business in America is most generated. And there is a value to being approximate to work. Even though I might work from home, there's a big difference if I live three blocks away than if I live 3,000 miles away. There's a huge difference there. So I don't think you're going to see the demise of New York City real estate. I think you're going to see some areas still in demand, but I do think many people in New York City in particular are going to begin to relocate into some of those areas that I mentioned earlier. And we see this here in South Florida all the time. In addition to New York City, there's other major metropolitan areas around the country. Some will fare better than others. All in all, there is going to be more of a suburban movement. But some cities, and I believe New York is one of those, will fare quite well. But in other cities, perhaps, such as Chicago, the Midwest cities, Chicago, Cincinnati, there seem to have already been much more flight from those areas into suburban areas and relocating even prior to the pandemic. And now I think you're going to see it will be harder for I don't want to say Chicago so much, but for cities like Cincinnati, Cleveland, it's going to be much more difficult for them to continue to have real estate growth, growth in prices in their residential real estate.
Ken H. Johnson is with us. He is a real estate economist from Florida Atlantic University. And Ken, there are a lot of people bemoaning the fact that millennials like to look at housing and cars as commodities that they weren't going to buy in. And of course, the home is the center of so much activity in terms of the buying of other durable goods and such. But millennials, now the largest living adult generation, they continue to age into prime home buying years. What did COVID mean to this generation? And are they going to be catching up to others? I know I'm a baby boomer, and we bought our houses early on in our 20s. Many of them aren't having families or children or even getting married until their 30s.
So this is going to be a boon for real estate pricing. This group is going to move into ownership. The ownership rates have gone up about 1.5%, 2% in the last year. That's a pretty significant move in terms of do you own and build equity or do you rent, right? And you got those two options in renting to either reinvest or just to spend the difference on consumption. So, but clearly this group is more into something that's customized. And if you're going to be into more customization, that's going to take you a little bit more towards ownership. Renting tends to become a more homogenous product in general. You can find really nice rentals or very Spartan ownership settings, but generally speaking, customization will lead them towards ownership a little, just fractionally more. But I think this will be the group that will figure it out. That, okay, I'm either going to rent and reinvest, right, in a portfolio of stocks and bonds, mm-hmm. or I'm going to own. What I'm not going to do is rent and spend the difference on consumption. And this group is going to, I think, financially come out far better than the other generational groups that we always talk about.
In a Wall Street Journal piece recently, they said that those trying to break into the market for the first time have rarely found it more difficult. So the first-time buyers, and I'm talking about a lot of millennials, we've got low interest rates. Many of them have really good professional jobs. I mean, they're not in a position, or is it that they don't have the equity from a previous home that gives them the flexibility to get into what has really become a dating game where somebody puts something on the market one day and about 2 days later they have 12 offers and 10 of them are overbids?
Not only with millennials, but other groups, what I would say right now about housing prices is housing prices follow pretty much a linear trend through time. And then at times, though, you'll see they'll be a little bit below, and then sometimes they'll be a little bit above that long-term pricing trend. And that's one of the ways we measure this degree of overpricing and whether or not, you know, where is pricing relative to where it should be. Right now, we are near the peak of a housing cycle. So anybody thinking about buying right now, they need to be very aggressive. They need to understand that there will always be another house, if not tomorrow, a few years from now, or a few weeks from now. So you got to think about, boy, in 2012, at the bottom of the last, or the start of this current cycle, which was the bottom of the last cycle, a 10th grader could make a good housing buy. It didn't take any effort to negotiate or find a place with a good price. They were all at good prices. You were at the bottom of the housing cycle. Today, we're near the peak of the housing cycle. I think you're going to see, even though some people lean towards ownership because of record low rates, I think you're going to see a slowdown in that, and you're going to see quite a few more people looking to rent because they don't want to make this decision now because they know prices, they'll stop going up so fast, they might not crash, but they might go flat for several years, right? Or slow way down. Property appreciation would slow way down because we've got to come back to that long-term pricing trend. We're 13% in Southeast Florida above that trend where we should be. Right now, I think a lot of people are going to be in that that mode of renting. And for goodness sakes, I hope they rent and take that money they would have spent on housing and keep investing it. And when prices come back to more normal ranges, which they will, you know, housing prices don't grow to the sky. You know, everybody, they just don't. There's going to be a readjustment. And so when they do come back, when they do become more reasonable, then those individuals that rented and reinvested, they're sitting there waiting with their nest egg to make their down payment if they want to switch into ownership.
Is the fact that we see new construction is really pretty low, and so it's really tough to find the land, I guess, find the money. Wood is very expensive right now. Was that an outgrowth of us just trying to get ourselves back on track after the debacle in the, 10 period of time to 12 and trying to dig our way out of this that nobody was building for some period of time? Explain the issue with new construction.
This is the underpinning of why prices won't come down. We are tremendously short on inventory. I might be just a tad off in my numbers, but I was looking at this a couple weeks ago. Roughly since 2007 until just a few months ago, we produced below the average number of new units per month. So 13 plus years, we were not producing at the average level of unit production, meaning we weren't building enough houses every month. And that was for almost 13 years. Now you go back to 5 and 6, we were at record levels of production. But we've gone 13 plus years with significant below average production in housing, creating a huge inventory shortage. This is not going to disappear overnight. It was a decade plus in the making. It will be a decade in the correction. And it's very difficult to develop product right now, for a myriad of reasons. And we've got to find a way for developers to put more product in the ground, to have the economic, the profit incentive to build more properties.
When we look at the most desirable places, and you live in one, Boca Raton, the supply shortage in the luxury market seems to be less severe than in other price tiers, partly because more high-end homeowners are putting their properties up for sale. What do you see happening in the different tiers? If I wanted to get in at a lower range, 150 to 250,000, or that mid-range of 350 to 400 to 500, and then when we start talking luxury, how do you look at the various gradations?
There's a pattern in housing price appreciation, and it goes like this. The low end of the market and the high end of the market are most susceptible to swings. So when the market is going south, the low end of the housing market and the high end of the housing market gets hit the hardest. When housing is moving up rapidly in value, the low end of the market and the high end of the market appreciate the fastest. And nobody can really explain why that goes on. It happens every time. I can see it in the high end of the market, because people are buying at that discretionary income, and it is a consumption good. I just want the place that's looking at the ocean. Doesn't necessarily make financial sense why they pay what they pay for that particular property, but it makes sense in terms of consumption. You know, I like this burger. I want to buy this burger. I like this house on the ocean. I want to buy this house on the ocean. So you see the greatest swings in the high end of the market and the low end of the market during times of upheaval, either property price appreciation or depreciation. In the middle of the market, it just isn't as significant. And so I would say that, you know, that pattern's not going to change this time. I don't see anything changing it in the future. So I would end on that, and that just, you know, if you're thinking about getting into the market, let me back up just a little bit. When you're thinking about getting in the market, what you're really saying is, from a financial standpoint, is I'm thinking about saving. And again, if you'll fall back to rent and reinvest or buy and own, choose one of those two. In the long run, there won't be much difference. Keep in mind that you're at the peak of a housing cycle right now. I personally would be, but I'm very conservative financially, I would personally be a little bit more leaning towards renting and reinvesting right now, because I think those opportunities are going to come.
Do you see much difference in different parts of the country right now? I know that we here in the Northeast, and we've been battered. Believe it or not, Connecticut has been in a real economic doldrums for some time because we bought into the suburban solution harder and faster and earlier than most. And now we seem to be benefiting from that. Do you see a lot of differential between regions of the country? You did talk about the Midwest.
Yeah, if there are clear differentials. In the Midwest is one of the more sluggish economically parts of the country. It's people are just not growing. If you watch population patterns, you don't find 10% expected increase in population in many areas in the Midwest. You can come into the Southeast and find dozens upon dozens of areas of the country that they're expecting 10% plus growth in population. I'm originally from Alabama, so one of those areas, ironically, is in Gulf Shores, Alabama. They're expecting 24% increase in their population in this little metropolitan area in the next 10 years. Fort Myers, Florida, 20%. Southeast Florida, 15%. You don't find those in the Midwest or even much of the Northwest, Seattle or perhaps Portland. So there are parts of the country that are going to benefit more. And it's people making choices over what they like and their quality of life. I think you see the people that like warm weather are coming to Florida and Texas and to some extent Tennessee, which I find quite ironic living in Southeast Florida. I think Tennessee is really cold. But people are buying weather. People are buying business opportunities. And those places that have that potential for growth or have that potential for quality of life are going to benefit the most. Now, other areas of the country, even, and I mentioned Gulf Shores, Alabama, if you go just inland to the state capital of Alabama, which is Montgomery, Alabama, they expect 0% growth in the next 10 years, population expectation. So it can change very, very quickly, and it doesn't mean – so if one state's doing well or one part of the state is doing well, it does not mean the whole state is doing well.
I take it that climate change really is having no bearing on the thought process of most people today. I did a podcast, Ken, where there was another economist from New Orleans who suggested that habitable places in America are going to be fewer than they are today, and that many of the places you mentioned aren't going to be the most habitable going forward, and it may be difficult to get a mortgage or insurance given the extremities of the weather. What do you say to that?
A couple of things. I would tell you that the Dutch have lived below sea level for 300 years, and we'll figure this out. It will be pretty expensive to figure out. I do not see New Orleans or residential areas in New Orleans, Miami, different parts, places along the coastline. I don't see residential areas disappearing. The Dutch, again, have lived below sea level for 300 years. We will figure this out as well. Another thing that's happening, however, is that research is out there, and it shows that as sea level encroaches your property, not the property line, but the dwelling, that it doesn't impact the price. It's very slow to react. So if you can watch how close the water is to the dwelling, at first as it begins to encroach, you see no change in price, no change in likelihood of a transaction, no change in the time on the market. However, as it encroaches again and again, closer and closer, all of a sudden at the last minute, you see dramatic changes in price, dramatic changes in the likelihood of a sale, longer marketing times. So it's like nobody worries about the wolf until the wolf is at the door. What that means is this long-term solution that we will solve is probably not going to be market-driven, but will probably be government-driven.
Interesting. Speaking of government, as you look at the spending that's going on the federal level, what impact does all that have on mortgage rates, which remain near historic lows, and how much do you attribute a lot of what we've seen happen in this recent period to those mortgage rates? And what do you imagine might happen in the coming period?
It's very directly tied to the stimulus and all the monies that have been pumped in to prop up the economy, which we had to do this. Now, but our debate's going to be, was the magnitude, was it too big, too small? And time will tell on that. But with this money and what we're finding now, and I believe it was Bernanke that began to argue for that inflation was coming into financial assets. And we saw this the last time around when we had a lot of this quantitative easing. What you find very quickly is money that is pumped into the economy by the government finds its way into financial assets. It's not so much consumption on consumer goods anymore. Like in the old days, that was people didn't have these investment alternatives. Now there's extra money floating around. It's going to chase returns. And so one of the safe places to be was, wow, let's buy 30-year mortgage-backed securities. Let's buy 15-year mortgage-backed securities. This is money that's out there. It's getting huge. And imagine mortgages like they were houses or neighborhoods to live in. The 30-year mortgages became a very popular neighborhood. A lot of money flowed in, bid the price up, and as prices bid up, yields go down. The money that came about from the stimulus is directly related to and probably the principal cause of setting near record low interest rates. Mortgages became high in demand, drove price up, drove yield down, meaning drove rates down. And when that tapering starts, that's when you'll start to see mortgage rates come back up. But they're directly causal. Without this huge stimulus, without the huge actions of the federal government, we would have never seen the record low interest rates that we're seeing right now.
And let me ask you, how did we get out of the bottom that we hit back in 2010, 11, 12? How did we really pull out of that?
Eventually, house prices became so low, just as we were saying in 2005 and 6, that's just too high. Many people around 2011 and 12, depending on where you were, that's about the bottom around the country, people just said, those prices are too low. I'll never get a deal this good again. And coincidentally, I was here in Southeast Florida, and in 2012, I told my wife, we'll never get a chance to buy this low again. And we transitioned back from, we went ownership to renting, and then renting back to ownership. Because the prices just get too low. Now, I don't think we're going to see that again. So we're not going to need that. Oh, my gosh, the prices are just so low. Let's start to buy again. I think you're going to see why I can create wealth through ownership. I can create wealth through renting and reinvesting. When the prices moderate back down relative to incomes, which are increasing, and depending on where rates go, I think rates are going up, but not tremendously high. I don't think. If we go to 4%, we're going to have a problem in the next year. I just don't see that happening. I see them going to 3.4, 3.5. That's not going to really affect the housing demand so much. It's going to slow it down. And it will throw cold water on a raging fire that's out there where you're seeing prices jump so tremendously and you're seeing these bidding wars. I think you'll see bidding wars stop at 3.5%. But then we'll get more back to a pattern of, that's the neighborhood I want my kids to live in so they can go to the right schools. And I've got friends that live in there and we like the community, all the benefits of this particular community. The things that have traditionally made people buy will be more in vogue a few months down the road. Right now, there's quite a bit of mania out there. And again, I would encourage people to think about if, you know, maybe you don't have to buy or sell or rent right now. Stay where you are. But if you do have to either buy or rent, I might be thinking about renting and reinvesting right now.
Let me ask you in closing, foreclosure activity. Of course, as we go back to the housing crash, we had these millions of foreclosures. They flooded the market, and that depressed prices. You don't see that, or when should we look as to whether people really went above their skis during this boom?
I don't think you're going to see much of a foreclosure crisis. Will foreclosures go up a little bit, almost certainly because of this, but I don't see it being a crisis. The credit ratings of the average Americans are at 30-year record highs. Americans that own, on average, our equity. I think you brought up the number. I think it was around $1.3 trillion, I believe.
Yeah, and equity
that's been built up. People aren't going to walk away because they fall a couple of payments behind, right, on their home, which I don't see that happening. But they've got good credit. They've got equity in their homes. Foreclosures are just not going to be a major issue this time around. The foreclosures were like throwing more gas on an already overheated fire a decade and a half ago. The market was crashing. People, they didn't have the best of credit. The house values had actually gone underwater. There was no equity left in the house, and people just walked away. That's not happening this time around. I'm going to save my credit. And you know what? My house might have gone from $1 million to $800,000, but I only owe $500,000, and I'm not walking on the other $300,000 in value.
So okay.
Foreclosures just should not be an issue this time.
Well, Ken H. Johnson, I can't thank you enough. You've really explained things in terms that I think we can all understand and try to make sense of the fire that's raging around us. And I hear story after story from people who are in the market today on one side of the equation or another. But a very interesting moment in time for housing and for somebody who's a real estate economist, as you are, at Florida Atlantic University. Thank you for being with us on America Trends.
Thank you, Larry. I enjoyed it very much.